Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, January 24, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing the new book, Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade, with our author, Clark Forsyth, and we'll have commentator as well. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. I just mentioned that we're joined today by author Clark Forsyth. In addition to having written Abuse of Discretion, he is Senior Counsel at Americans United for Life. And I trust we are also joined now by Professor Jeffrey Rosen, who is President and Chief Executive Officer of the National Constitution Center. Professor Rosen, are you there?
I am indeed, and looking forward to the call.
Terrific. Mr. Forsyth is going to discuss his book for about 8 to 12 minutes, after which we're going to have commentary by Professor Rosen. Then we'll have a little back and forth, and then, as always, we'll be turning to our audience for your questions. So please stand by with those questions. And with that, Mr. Forsyth, the floor is yours.
Well, I want to thank Dean and David for organizing today's teleforum, and I want to thank Professor Rosen for being a respondent today. And I want to thank all of you online for coming today to hear about the little-known case of Roe versus Wade. The conventional history of Roe is that it was, quote, considered with special care, unquote. That's what Justice Powell said in 1983 in his opinion in the Akron decision. And in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, the plurality of Justices O'Connor and Kennedy and Souter said that Roe, quote, was a reasoned statement elaborated with great care, unquote. Well, based on my findings in Abuse of Discretion, I suggest that that proposition is no longer defensible based on the record we now have. The papers of several of the justices have been released over the past 10 years, including Justices Blackmun, Brennan, Stewart, Whites, and Rehnquist. And I've had a chance to look at 8 of the 9 who voted in Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton, all but Chief Justice Burgers. And I submit that Abuse of Discretion may be the most important book written about Roe since Roe, simply because these papers have been released to the public in recent years. And they are critical, perhaps first and foremost, because there was no trial and no evidentiary record in either Roe or Doe. And based on the review of the papers, Abuse of Discretion tells the story of the mistakes made by the justices and what I consider the unintended consequences that we're still living with. And before I go any farther, I think it's important to point out that what we call Roe versus Wade is really two cases from two states, Doe versus Bolton from Georgia and Roe versus Wade from Texas. And you really can't understand our national policy on abortion without reading the two cases together as the court instructed. In Roe, the court suggested that the states could prohibit abortion after fetal viability, quote, except where it is necessary for the preservation of the life or health of the mother, unquote. But in Doe, the court added a significant health exception that is often overlooked. The justices defined health as, quote, all factors, physical, emotional, psychological, familial, and the woman's age, relevant to the well-being of the patient, unquote. So health in abortion law has meant basically emotional well-being without limits, and this health exception swallowed the supposed ability of the states to prohibit abortion after fetal viability. So Roe and Doe were sweeping decisions. It left the U.S. as one of only four nations, including Canada, North Korea, and China, that allow abortion for any reason after fetal viability. Well, here's a short summary of how Roe happened. One of the things I was most surprised about when I got into the justices' papers was to find that Roe began as a procedural mistake. The justices took Roe and Doe in April 1971 in order to decide the application of Younger versus Harris to the factual scenario of Roe and Doe, and in part to decide the application of Dombrowski versus Pfister. In fact, if you look at conference lists of the justices in April 71, For example, Justice White's conference list says over four Dombrowski holds. So the court took the cases not to decide the abortion issue, but to decide what might be seen as a mundane jurisdictional issue between the state and federal courts. And that's a story that Justice Blackmun has told to a number of people over the years. But then the crisis of September 71 erupted when Justices Black and Harlan abruptly retired within the space of a week due to ill health. Justice Black died within a week. Justice Harlan died at the end of 1971. That reduced the number of justices to seven, and it empowered a temporary block of four justices, Justices Douglas, Brennan, Stewart, and Marshall, to decide to use the two cases to resolve the jurisdictional issue and to decide to use the cases to sweep away the abortion laws and declare a right to abortion. And they developed such momentum that that couldn't be reversed even after Justices Powell and Rehnquist joined the court in January 1972. And if you look at the cases decided during those 15-week vacancies, there are a number of others that break down in that 4-3 division, or the basic 4-3 division. The most famous might be Eisenstadt versus Baird, but there's also the case of Mitchum versus Foster at 407 U.S. 225, which basically resolved the jurisdictional issue that was in Roe and Doe but not decided in Roe and Doe. Then there's a second crisis that develops in May, June 72, after Justice Blackmun had distributed the first draft of his opinions in Roe and Doe, which basically found the statutes unconstitutional because they were unconstitutionally vague. And Chief Justice Berger suggested that the cases be re-argued. The four, Brennan, Douglas, Marshall, and Stewart, reacted to that, but eventually Powell and Rehnquist voted to rehear the cases, and they were reheard in October of 1972. Then subsequent drafts were written, and they were released in January 73. Well, throughout that process, I found what I consider to be the following four mistakes, at least, as I set out in detail in Abuse of Discretion. The first is there, when the four took the two jurisdictional cases to decide the abortion issue, they had two cases with no trial whatsoever, no evidentiary record whatsoever, and no record of facts. And that had huge implications for how Roe and Doe were written and the assumptions that the court made to base their decision on. The most important factual assumption of both cases was the medical notion that abortion was safer than childbirth. This, of course, there was no record, no evidentiary findings. So, where did they get this? Well, they got it from interest groups briefs that were filed in the Supreme Court, but there was no reliable data to suggest that abortion was safer than childbirth. The various medical sources that are cited in Roe and Doe have no data that would suggest that, and yet it drove the outcome in Roe and Doe. It shaped their understanding of the historical right to abortion. It shaped their deference to providers. It shaped their prohibition of health and safety regulations in the first trimester. It shaped their expansion of the right to viability and beyond. And yet there was no reliable data to demonstrate it then. And today it's based upon the mechanical comparison of the published abortion mortality rate and the published childbirth mortality rate. And yet these are non-comparable because what goes into the numerator and the denominator is simply completely different. The third surprise I found in the papers was that throughout the first two rounds of oral argument, the word viability was never mentioned even once. It was never briefed. It was never argued. And only after the second round of arguments and Justice Blackmun's second or third draft did the justices begin to talk about the scope of the abortion right they were creating. Up until that time, the drafts had talked about 12 weeks as being the decisive moment, but But after the second round, Justices Powell and Marshall prevailed on Justice Blackmun, or encouraged him to expand the right from 12 weeks to viability, which at that time they thought was 28 weeks, 16 whole weeks, 4 whole months, without any medical data whatsoever as to the implications of that expansion for late-term abortions, live birth abortions, implications for maternal health. There was simply no medical data whatsoever showing the safety of second trimester or third trimester abortions. And then finally, there is the fact that the justices prohibited health and safety regulations in the first trimester, which has created a public health vacuum that we see reflected in various scandals and clinics state by state, year by year. And even today, the court, after 41 years, the court has yet to approve health and safety regulations in the first trimester. Now, this is not just history, because two of the major propositions in Roe, the medical notion that abortion was safer than childbirth and the viability rule, is actually relevant to cases that have been before the court and may come before the court in this year or in coming years. The court just 10 days ago rejected a review in Horn versus Isaacson, Arizona case involving Arizona's 20-week limit. Arizona is one of 13 or more states that have passed a 20-week limit, and that 20-week limit brought into question the notion that abortion was safer than childbirth, at least for second trimester abortions, and the viability rule, and yet the court declined to hear the case, but other cases from other states may be forthcoming. So just to sum up, my conclusion was that Roe was the perfect storm. It was a unique combination of impulses and errors and miscalculations that came together during a brief 10 years of American history. And given the court's track record and their self-appointed role as the National Abortion Control Board, what justifies the court continuing in that role? Why should abortion, among all the public health issues, be controlled by the court? And 41 years later, I think those questions still need to be asked and answered.
Thank you very much. Professor Rosen, you want to take a few minutes and respond?
Well, I'm honored to be asked to respond to Clark Forsythe's important book. I am indeed, as you said, Dean, the head of the National Constitution Center, which has a congressional mandate to disseminate ideas about the U.S. Constitution on a nonpartisan basis. But I'm not speaking here as head of the NCC, but instead in my role as a law professor at George Washington University and someone who is privileged to review Clark's book for the Wall Street Journal. I think it is an impressive piece of scholarship. It is generally fair-minded, it is full of historical detail, and it's especially admirable given the contentious nature of this debate. Clark Forsythe has obviously taken strong views in this debate over the course of his career, but he has succeeded in his book in mining the papers of the justices to give us new insights into the story behind Roe versus Wade. The truth is that there have long been pro-choice critics of Roe, who, although they support the right to choose as a policy matter, believe that the Roe opinion was not convincing as a constitutional matter. The most prominent of them included Alexander Bickel, who wrote for the New Republic soon after Roe was decided, and John Hart Ely, who said that Roe really was not convincing as constitutional law. And the basis of their objections was that Roe's location of the right to choose in the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment wasn't adequately justified by constitutional history, tradition, or precedent. What Clark Forsythe has done in his book is to give fresh detail about the haphazard quality about the lines that the court drew itself. And I think the most riveting part of his book is, as he describes, the real way that the viability line was essentially pulled out of a hat. As Clark Forsythe describes, Harry Blackmun initially wanted to make the first trimester the point at which abortions could be allowed. And he said that this is arbitrary, but perhaps any selected point like quickening or viability is equally arbitrary. But his law clerk proposed viability, which occurs 3 months later, And Justice Powell's law clerk, who was influenced by a lower court opinion by Judge Newman, also championed viability. So it was really a pragmatic decision to extend the right to viability, a point that wasn't mentioned when Roe and Doe were argued in the lower courts and the Supreme Court. And it's true, as Clark Forsythe suggests, that a plurality of justices in the Planned Parenthood case stressed that the adoption of viability was a reasoned statement elaborated with great care that's not supported by the historical record. He also shows that the case was decided without an extensive factual record, and that therefore the assumption that abortion is safer than childbirth might not have been supported by the facts. But it's here that the not the constitutional history of the case, but the medical, legal, and philosophical history becomes ideologically contested. Clark Forsythe suggests, for example, that Blackmun misinterpreted the longstanding legal history about quickening. That's the point at which the mother can perceive the fetus's movement, and it can occur as early as 14 weeks. Until the 19th century, he says, abortions were rarely prosecuted because of uncertainty about if the fetus was alive. In other words, you couldn't tell when quickening occurred. He says that when, quote, medical science challenged the quickening rule in the 1800s by showing that conception was the beginning of the life of a human being, states quickly moved to repeal the quickening rule and replaced it with abortion prohibition from conception. This is, I think, where things become contested. It wasn't, of course, simply medical science that challenged the quickening rule. On the one hand, it was a religious notion that life begins at conception, which can't be proved or disproved by medical science. And it was also, as scholars such as Rita Siegel of Yale Law School suggest, who Clark Forsythe doesn't cite, efforts by an all-male American Medical Association to protect its monopoly on pregnancy-related health care against competition from female midwives. Siegel suggests that this helped enshrine stereotypes that mothers should bear children rather than making autonomous decisions about their lives and careers. I'm not taking a position in this debate except to note that it's worth engaging and may have relevance to the equal protection issues. So this is an area, the question of whether life begins at conception or not, that can't be solved by facts or medical science or by an extensive trial record that's full of ideological contestation, and I think, is perhaps more complicated than Clark Forsythe suggests. I also question his claim that the United States is the only country aside from one of only four nations allowing abortion for any reason after fetal viability. This is called into question by the transformative impact of the Gonzalez and Carhart case. That was the 2007 decision by the Supreme Court, which upheld the federal partial birth abortion law and doesn't contain a health exception and allows restrictions on abortion both before and after fetal viability. And that case, the Gonzalez case, is now being invoked by groups like Americans United for Life in defending current laws that restrict abortions throughout pregnancy, including the Arizona law that Clark mentioned earlier. So I think Gonzalez and Carhart really, its critics, of course, say that it misinterpreted Roe's strict protection for pre-viability abortions, but the justices made pretty clear in that case that they believed that after fetal viability, abortions could, as Casey said, be restricted or even banned for various reasons. And Gonzalez goes further and says that even pre-viability abortions, if conducted according to a certain procedure, can be banned as well. So things are not as stark, I think, as Clark suggests, and I look forward to debating that stark claim that the U.S. is one of only four nations allowing abortion for any reason after fetal viability. The reason I want to end this initial comment by expressing thanks and praise for Clark's book is because I think he really shows us the dangers of overly broad decisions, especially those made without careful factual analysis. He cites polls suggesting that the court leapt ahead of public opinion in 1972 to the degree that it allowed abortion at any point in a woman's pregnancy that might threaten psychological health, and speculates that if the court hadn't intervened, most states would have retained their criminal prohibitions, but some would have experimented with broad exceptions. He concedes, though, that for 40 years, a majority of Americans have agreed that abortion should only be legal under certain circumstances early in pregnancy. I've always been struck by the remarkably stable Gallup poll numbers, which really haven't changed much since Roe was decided. Between 1973 and 2011, majorities of between 70 and 80% of Americans have said that abortion should be legal in certain circumstances or in any circumstances. And only a small minority of Americans believe that abortion should be illegal in all circumstances, according to these polls and the numbers that Clark himself cites. So given that reality, most of the 30 very restrictive state abortion laws that Roe struck down might well have been repealed or revised by state legislatures, even without the Supreme Court's intervention. How quickly that would have occurred is anyone's guess. We can debate about what would happen if Roe were, in fact, overturned, how many states would retain their protections for abortion and how many would try to ban abortion outright. Clark Forsythe speculates that 10 to 12 states might maintain abortion on demand, 10 might prohibit abortion except to save the life of the mother, and 30 states might move toward a more restrictive policy than that allowed under Roe. My sense is that given the fact that even in the states most opposed to abortion, numbers not more than 20% in most cases support total bans, I doubt even that 10 states would prohibit abortion except to save the life of the mother. And as we saw in South Dakota, when the legislature tried to do that, that was overturned by popular initiative. But you know, of course, that's a debate worth having. We can't be sure of what would happen, except to know broadly that the country was much more moderate on this issue than Roe itself. Most Americans support the right to choose early in pregnancy and believe that it should be restricted later in pregnancy. And that's why I agree with Justice Ginsburg that the court should have ruled more narrowly in Roe, striking down the extreme Texas law while leaving it up to the states to decide the precise contours of the right to choose. And a narrower ruling would have allowed the debate to continue while people saw how public health was affected in the 13 states that allowed abortion under certain circumstances. So Clark Forsythe and I think, are agreed in the virtues of judicial minimalism, the dangers of deciding cases on an incomplete factual record, and most important of all, the dangers of, as Clark Forsythe puts it, formulating broad rules of constitutional law broader than required by the facts. Nowadays, of course, the shoe is on the other foot. It's liberals who are criticizing conservative justices for overly broad constitutional decisions in cases like Citizens United and the Shelby voting rights case. And I think Clark Forsythe's book is a very useful chronicle of the most prominent case in the past 40 years when the shoe was on the other foot. So thank him. I thank him for the book and look forward to our discussion.
Thank you, Professor. I do want to come back to Clark Forsythe, but before I do, let's open the floor to questions and let people begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open. And before we go to the audience, Mr. Forsythe, do you want to take a few minutes to respond?
Sure. Well, I thank Jeff for a very, very, very thorough response. Well, let me start by saying that I think readers will be interested in the 100 or so pages of endnotes that I have in Abuse of Discretion that documents virtually all that I say pretty thoroughly. And there are some aspects of history that I couldn't get into, not only because a publisher would revolt, but because I didn't need to go over the scholarship that's been done over the years. I would refer readers to and listeners to, for example, Joseph Della Penna's compendium, Dispelling the Myths of Abortion History, published by Caroline Academic Press in 2006. I think he very thoroughly disputes Reva Siegel's spotty history about the motivations behind 19th century abortion laws. Della Penna is the foremost expert on abortion law in the Western world, and his encyclopedic account, I think, puts to rest Reva Siegel's historical arguments, and I simply didn't need to repeat them. With respect to the laws, I think it's interesting also to point out, with reflections upon public opinion, that there was protection for fetal life in state property, prenatal injury, wrongful death, and fetal homicide law as of 71 and 72, and that the court in Roe said nothing about those laws, and the states have actually moved ahead in those areas. Virtually every state has a prenatal injury law that extends protection from conception. 36 to 38 states have fetal homicide laws. Half of the states, 25 states today, have fetal homicide laws that begin protection from conception. 36 to 38 states have wrongful death laws that treat the unborn child expressly as a person. And many of those extend protection from conception. So conception is not an abstraction. It's a legal principle in prenatal injury law and much of wrongful death and fetal homicide law. And the states have moved ahead, reflecting, I think, public opinion. With respect to the 1 in 4, I cite UN statistics documenting that. But the point is, I think the essential point is that North Korea, China, Canada, and the U.S. allow abortion for any reason after fetal viability. And in the U.S., it's because of Roe and Doe, reading the two together in the health exception. There are numerous federal courts that have struck down post-viability regulations. There are a couple of law review articles that document that the post-viability regulations that are on the books are unconstitutional. The court in 1997 in the Voinovich case allowed a federal appellate court decision to stand, striking down a post-viability regulation because it didn't allow a broad health exception. Gonzalez versus Carhart is an exceedingly narrow opinion. It just upheld the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, which was an exceedingly narrow statute with a commerce clause an essential factor. Gonzalez versus Carhart doesn't extend, I mean, on its face, it doesn't extend any farther than upholding that narrow statute. And it hasn't been extended since then, and the Ninth Circuit in Horn versus Isaacson said that it was that narrow and shouldn't be extended any farther. So I welcome questions and any further response from Professor Rosen.
Very good. We've got two callers with questions at this point. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's check in with our first caller.
My question is for Professor Rosen. Professor Rosen, this is Teresa Collette. I'm a professor at the University of St. Thomas.
Of course, we've met, and it's a pleasure to hear from you.
We have, and I greatly appreciate your very careful and reasoned response to Clark's book. The place I want to explore with you is your statement that science cannot answer the question of human life begins at conception. And in the Eighth Circuit, where our university is, we had the case of Planned Parenthood versus Rounds, where the state of South Dakota had required that prior to an abortion, woman be told that abortion terminates the life of a separate, unique human being. And in an en banc divided decision, but nonetheless an en banc decision of the Eighth Circuit, a majority of those justices in upholding the law made the statement that Planned Parenthood has presented no evidence, and they used that phrase, no evidence to support the position that it is not a human being. The majority goes on to cite Planned Parenthood's own expert, who talks about it being a developing member of the species Homo sapien. The dissent's only response to the fact that there was no evidence that it was not a human being was to simply cite the Planned Parenthood mystery language, saying that, you know, the Supreme Court's been clear that you can't say whether life begins at conception, and therefore this law is clearly unconstitutional under the mystery language. How does that opinion relate to your position that science simply can't answer this important question?
Fascinating decision. Thank you for calling it to my attention. I'd be interested, of course, in flipping it and asking what the evidence, the scientific evidence would be that life does begin at conception. And in responding to that, I'd note people have extremely conflicted and complicated views about this question, and it's those views that can't be settled by scientific evidence. So Clark Forsythe usefully noted that a lot of states have fetal homicide laws on the books, and they're supported by strong majorities of the American people. The same supermajorities that support those fetal homicide laws also believe that there should be a right to choose early in pregnancy. You could say that people are irrational or conflicted. How could it be that they believe that, you know, people should be punished for killing fetuses in the course of a homicide, but also protect the mother's right to choose? It may be that they're balancing the interests of the mother against the interests of what they believe to be a full human being. It may be that they believe that although the fetus is a form of life, it doesn't deserve to be treated as a full human being until after viability, but nevertheless people should be punished for snuffing out the potentiality of life. It could be something else. But these are not scientific questions. They are religious and philosophical questions. The various religions, of course, disagree about when life begins. Judaism disagrees with the Catholic Church on this question. And there's no, you know, science can suggest what the capacities of a zygote or an embryo are, but it can't tell us at what point that developing human life deserves to be treated as a full human life. Now, I think that it's not clear that the Roe Court was right glibly to say we can't and won't decide when life begins. There's an interesting argument by Jed Rubenfeld of Yale Law School that, in fact, the court had to decide that question because if the mother has a fundamental right of autonomy to choose abortion, then the only point at which that right could be overruled by the rights of the fetus are the point at which the fetus can be treated as a full constitutional human being. And therefore, Rubenfeld suggested that really viability should have been identified as the point when the fetus can be treated and should be treated as a full human being with full human constitutional rights. Others have drawn a line elsewhere. So I'm by saying that science can't settle the question, I'm not saying that it can be avoided forever constitutionally, but I am saying I think the religious disagreement on this issue confirms that people just have very, very strong differences of belief, all made in good faith and good conscience, which I respect, but they're not going to be settled by science.
Clark Forsythe, do you want to jump in here?
Oh, I think that was a good exchange, and I'll leave it as is.
All right, very good. We've got just one caller question pending at this point. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Jim Markowski, a lawyer in New York. You know, my question is so fundamental it may be a really dumb question, but if a woman has the right to terminate a pregnancy, then shouldn't, by the same logic and reasoning, laws providing for fetal homicide or wrongful death of a fetus be unconstitutional? If it's not okay for a mother to kill her adult or her child that's born, and it's murder for someone else to kill that child, but why should there be an exception? It doesn't seem logically consistent to me, and I rarely have seen anyone address that kind of that fundamental inconsistency.
Well, if I may jump in, the court did not address it in Roe and Doe, and there's, I suppose, a difference between the logical inconsistency, which I agree stands. The court has, I suppose, justified it or avoided it with the distinction that they've said that the woman has a 14th Amendment liberty interest or right that a third party does not have. And so, in fact, the distinction, the contradiction between the two has actually been raised in a number of cases. Criminal defendants who were found guilty under fetal homicide laws have, or even under, I suppose, wrongful death laws, have appealed these cases, their convictions, to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has invariably denied review over the past 40 years. And I suppose that contradiction could continue with the court just refusing to resolve it as a constitutional matter. Simple explanation as a legal matter under the Roe Doctrine is that the drunk driver and the bank robber and the estranged boyfriend who kills a woman and kills her unborn child has no 14th Amendment liberty interest and therefore can't be exempt. And even equal protection objections to such convictions have been rejected or the court has refused to take them. So that's kind of the state of the law, and yet these laws have moved ahead in many states, and they're routinely enforced and juries convict.
Well, I mean, since there's no other questions in the queue, kind of an analogous follow-up. So a woman decides she's going to have an abortion and puts it off for a week, lo and behold, gives birth and kills the kid. So we're talking about it could be a day, right? She's supposed to go for the abortion that the next day, doesn't get there, and gives birth a little early the following day and disposes of the baby. The logical distinction between one day is so thin that it doesn't seem to stand as a matter of just basic common sense.
Well, that is an interesting conflict too, because the infanticide laws since 1973 have continued to be enforced, and women who have killed their children after birth or third party assistance have often been convicted, and you hear from time to time in various metro areas about infanticide charges for killing, and yet the court has not addressed those and has not extended its Roe and Doe decisions to encompass those. So that contradiction continues in the law as well.
It sounded like you wanted to say something there.
I think it's a fascinating question, and I'd love to talk about it. You're absolutely right that many states both have fetal homicide laws on the books and also protect the right to choose before viability. And this is consistent with public opinion. In recent surveys, more than 90% of Americans say they'd support a federal law that increases punishment for perpetrators who harm an unborn child, while more than two-thirds oppose laws that restrict first trimester abortions. I'm drawing here on a piece I wrote for Legal Affairs in 2003 on this very question. And I argued there that there's no tension between these laws and Roe v. Wade. In rejecting a challenge to one of the fetal homicide laws in Minnesota, the Supreme Court of Minnesota said that although the law treats fetuses as legal persons, it doesn't violate Roe v. Wade by treating them as constitutional persons. Because states are free to pass laws protecting the potentiality of human life as long as they do so without impinging directly or indirectly on a pregnant woman's privacy rights. A dissenting justice said that the state's interest in protecting a fetus only became compelling after viability. This is convincing. John Hart Ely, who I mentioned earlier is a pro-choice critic of Roe, famously observed that the government can protect the interests of those who are not persons. It can forbid cruelty to animals, for example. But it can't protect the interests of non-persons in a way that makes the exercise of fundamental rights by a person impossible. So in other words, the fetal homicide laws may be treating fetuses as entities with legal interests without treating them as full constitutional persons, although some may say otherwise in their preambles. Also, the idea that a legal person may not have all the rights of a constitutional person is not novel. We now know from Citizens United that corporations have certain First Amendment rights, but they don't have full rights to, and we'll find out whether they have the same rights of religious liberties as natural persons. So the rights of persons can vary under different circumstances. And it's also not true that these fetal homicide laws will necessarily undermine Roe, because once a fetus is a full constitutional person, state governments not only have to pass laws prohibiting abortion, but arguably must do so. But the states that have recognized fetuses as legal persons have recognized in the same statutes, the fetal homicide statutes themselves, a woman's right to choose. So this must mean that whatever conception of fetal personhoods the states and Congress are embracing differs from full constitutional personhoods, and far from threatening abortion rights, the legislative declarations could be said to strengthen them. For me, these two laws just reinforce the idea that in a pluralistic society, citizens have complicated, sometimes clashing, not always, you know, logically consistent to the degree of a mathematical syllogism, but perfectly plausible intuitions, beliefs, you know, fundamental instincts, and that it's a good thing that people are both protecting fetuses against homicide and protecting a woman's right to choose. But I think it's a great question. There's a lot more to say about it.
We do have three other questions pending now, so let's move on to our next caller.
This is Matt McReynolds in Sacramento, California. I want to thank both gentlemen and the Federalist Society for a fascinating discussion today. And I wonder if Mr. Forsyth might be able to elaborate a little bit more about the some of the external non-legal factors that influence some of the justices in the case. I've heard in the past about Justice Powell being influenced by clerks who had experience with abortion, and other justices being influenced by wives and daughters. So I wonder if there might be a little more elaboration in that regard.
Sure, I'd be happy to address that. I address that actually in Chapter 2 of Abuse of Discretion, and I would encourage you to take a look at that. I can summarize some of that. I address 8 or 10 factors in the law and culture of the 1960s that I think influenced the justices. Yeah, I don't recall finding much evidence about wives and girlfriends, but for example, it has been documented that a number of the justices had some personal contact with abortion unwed pregnancy in their family or family history, and that apparently influenced them. Justice Powell told a story to a number of people about how when he was in private practice in Richmond, Virginia, he talked to the local authorities after a so-called, quote-unquote, office boy had come to him about trying to abort his girlfriend, and which resulted in her death. And Justice Powell intervened, or the attorney Powell intervened on behalf of him, and got the charges either never filed or dropped. So there are interesting personal anecdotes like that. I think the population crisis, the so-called population crisis of the 1960s, certainly influenced a number of the justices. It was a large national issue, emphasized by Robert McNamara as president of the World Bank. There was a national statement by President Nixon in July of 1969 about population crisis and the American future, in which he appointed a presidential commission headed up by John D. Rockefeller III, I think. And that influenced, I think, a number of the justices, especially Justice Stewart. And there were just a number of other factors that I outline that I think generally can be tied to influencing the justices and perhaps their motivations. I think the population crisis is hinted at the beginning and the end of Justice Blackmun's opinion in Roe versus Wade, where he talks about some of the pending problems of the day, and I think the population crisis was an influence there, at least hinted at. But I address some of those factors that I think might have motivated the justices more at length in Chapter 2 of Abuse of Discretion.
Let me just chime in briefly to say I thought that was a fascinating discussion, and in particular the real concern about the population crisis that moved Justice Stewart, which of course proved to be ill-founded, and nowadays the West is worrying about too low population growth, not too much, suggests the dangers of relying on temporary and faddish demographic concerns rather than on constitutional principles. So I thought that was a great part of the book.
We still have three questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, we've got about 15 minutes left. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Hi, my name is Gunnar Gunderson. I'm an attorney in Orange County, and I actually wanted to go back to the first question because I felt like the professor kind of shifted the scope, because the first questioner asked about what scientific evidence there was that the life that begins at conception is not a human life, and he responded that there are various religious or philosophic points of view, but that's not scientific evidence. So I guess I had two questions that kind of came out of that. The first one being for Professor Rose, and the second one for both the interlocutors here. Other than religious or philosophical disagreements about when life begins, are you aware of any evidence that the life that begins at conception is not a human life that could be the proper basis for a judicial opinion based on fact? And then for both of you, what role should these kind of religious or philosophic opinions play, these kind of opinions that can be tested by fact or reason, what role should they play in court decisions that apply to all Americans, regardless of their religious beliefs? Anyway, that's my question.
I'll start, I think, with the second question and then return to the first. Justice Holmes famously said that the Constitution is made for people of fundamentally differing points of view. And really, that's the wisest lesson of judicial restraint that we learned over the 20th century, that when you have questions about which reasonable people fundamentally and passionately disagree, it's not appropriate for the Constitution to short-circuit those debates and to take a strong side on one rather than the other. And Roe, according to its pro-choice critics, and certainly according to Clark Forsythe's book, has been legitimately criticizing for short-circuiting a debate about the proper scope of abortion restrictions throughout pregnancy, about which the American people fundamentally and passionately disagreed. And in that sense, I think he makes a very good case for judicial restraint. Now, the question, your first question about what, scientific evidence, I think you said, is there that the life that begins at conception isn't a full human life, of course, begs the question. Exactly what sort of life begins at conception and whether it should be treated as a full human life is one that science cannot answer. Some form of life begins at conception, or there are non-human forms of life that begin throughout the animal kingdom, and the question of whether this fetus, which obviously has the potential and will within 9 months become a full human life, should be treated as a full human life from the moment of conception, is one that science simply can't and hasn't presumed to try to answer. And the fact that citizens, in fact, I think even majority of citizens, believe that the fertilized embryo should not be treated as a full human life, and are not likely to have their point of view changed by whatever scientific evidence is presented to them, should itself counsel humility in trying to invoke science to address this most contestable issue. So I think no one denies that some form of life begins at conception, but the point at which it should be treated as a full human life entitled to full constitutional rights is one about citizens legitimately and passionately disagree.
Well, quick follow-up, I guess, before Forsythe jumps in. But I guess the follow-up on that, though, is that there was great religious and philosophic debate of people, presumably of goodwill, about the humanity of blacks in America before the Civil War. But that was all based on maybe a very strongly, conscientiously held religious, philosophic opinion that had nothing to do with the fact that those people are human beings.
That's a powerful rejoinder. That terrible injustice as well was not one that was resolved by science, of course, but by appreciation of the fundamental humanity of all human beings, thankfully so.
This is Clark. I would refer listeners to my article at 32 Valparaiso University Law Review, 469 in 1998, on human cloning and the Constitution, in which I cite numerous embryological texts. And I think actually we can clarify some of the underbrush here by looking at embryological texts and focusing on what we can learn from anthropology about who's considered a member or what is considered a member of the human species and can be called human, and from biology as to what is an individual organism of any species. Embryology can tell us, anthropology and DNA can tell us if it's human, and biology can tell us whether it's an individual member of a particular species. And I cite numerous embryological texts which say that the beginning of a life of a human being begins with the zygote, or the beginning of the life of an individual human organism begins with the zygote. It's of course that the biology and anthropology is one question. Whether anybody wants to respect it is a very different question, and whether judges will treat it as with respect or treat it as a person, of course, is another question too. But it really comes down to biology and anthropology, and the embryological texts are pretty clear on the question.
Yeah, still got three questions pending. We're going to go to that. We're going to need to go to the next caller. We've got three questions pending and just a few minutes left. So.
Hi, this is Tony Kolenka, professor at Florida Coastal School of Law. I have a question. In Justice Blackmun's Roe opinion, he talks about that if the fetus was a person under the language and meaning of the 14th Amendment, that the right to life would then be guaranteed by the amendment. And what's always struck me as interesting is that Justice Rehnquist and White, in their dissenting opinions, and even any of the dissenters after in other abortion cases, nobody ever seems to make the argument that the fetus is a person under the 14th Amendment. And I'm wondering if there was anything in any of the notes, especially, I guess, of Rehnquist and White, or anything else you might think of that is worth commenting on, why none of the justices seem to, at any point, have wanted to go out on that limb.
Well, this is Clark. First of all, constitutional personhood as a legal proposition was argued in the first and second rounds of Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton. And actually, if you go to the oye.org website, oyez.org website, you can hear the original audio in both rounds of the arguments and read the transcripts, and they're very interesting. But both the Assistant Attorney Generals for Texas and the Assistant Attorney General for Georgia argued that. I found nothing in Justice Rehnquist's or Justice White's papers to indicate they considered that. They're both rather thin in that regard. If I can, I'd like to address of Blackmun's proposition that if constitutional personhood was proven, the plaintiff's case collapses or whatever. As a legal matter, that's actually wrong, as are a lot of other legal statements in Blackmun's majority opinion, because the 14th Amendment, of course, works through the Due Process and Equal Protection Clause. Both have a state action requirement, and if the unborn child would be a person within the 14th Amendment, it would only limit state action. It says nothing about it would have no implications for a possible pre-existing private right if one existed. So if, for example, there was a pre-existing common law private right to abortion, which I don't think history shows, but assuming there was, the 14th Amendment, which only applies against state action, wouldn't necessarily cancel it out. And others have pointed that out, and Blackmun just completely overlooked that distinction. And that, along with a lot of other legal statements, are simply wrong.
Let's try and get another question in here.
Yes, my question is that In the review of the backstory of the abortion jurisprudence, have the courts considered the woman's right to privacy argument in the context of whether there was the volitional act by the woman to become impregnated, except in the rare circumstances of perhaps rape or mental capacity, acted as a form of, I guess, waiver or estoppel or assumption of the risk for the ensuing pregnancy and would frustrate the ability to assert that right? And if not, your thoughts on why that aspect of the argument hasn't been raised?
Well, I have seen nothing really in the papers, and 8 of the 9 have been released, all but Chief Justice Berger's, which are put off until 2025. But in looking at the papers of 8 of the 9 that voted, I saw nothing that really examined that at all. It's only been touched upon perhaps by Justice Stevens and in subsequent opinions, perhaps. I don't think that any of the justices have really put much emphasis in it, but as to the original arguments and deliberations in Roe and Doe, I think perhaps it wasn't addressed in part because there was no trial, there was no evidentiary record, and there was no intermediate appellate review even. The justices took the two cases directly from the district courts. There was direct appeal at that time under a federal statute, and there was really no development of the record whatsoever, and perhaps that might have been raised in a trial or evidentiary hearings if there had been any, but there weren't.
We've got one question remaining. Let's try and get to this last question if the caller can be as quick as possible.
Hi, I'm Sam Cashery, lawyer in Chicago. Speaking as a former embryo, I'd like to raise this issue. There's been a lot of back and forth about, you know, can we know when life begins? And some say conception, some say later on. Shouldn't we be, you know, erring on the side of caution here? You know, there's the distinct possibility that we are ending human lives in abortion. Shouldn't we not do that until we're absolutely sure? Or what kind of threshold of certainty would each of you want to put on that?
That's a great question. I think I would just say that the balance that the American people have struck seems sensible, which is that when no one else's rights are at stake, as in the fetal homicide laws, you do err on the side of caution and treat the fetus, if not as a full constitutional person, at least as an entity with legal rights that deserve to be strongly taken into account. By contrast, in the abortion context, when someone else's rights, which the Supreme Court has recognized, you know, for better or for worse, as a fundamental constitutional status, are at stake as well, then far from erring on the side of caution, you only allow the woman's rights to be trumped at the point at which the fetus can be treated with confidence as a full constitutional person. That's, in any event, the line the court has drawn.
Clark Forsythe, final word here.
I would add that I think that proposition and erring on the side of caution is one of many reasons why the abortion right should not be judicially decided and imposed as a nationwide policy, but Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton should be overturned and the issue returned to the people so that people can decide that. And I think that over the course of a number of legislative sessions, I think you would see the American people decide abortion policy perhaps more in concert with prenatal injury, wrongful death, and fetal homicide law, and it would be closer and more coherent than disparate.
Well, thank you very much, Clark Forsythe. He is the author of Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe versus Wade. It's available at Amazon.com, and also there's a link on our webpage to get you to the book. I also want to thank Professor Jeffrey Rosen, and we wish to our audience a good weekend. Please check in on our website for information on upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until our next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia,
please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.